Welcome to Special Sauce, Serious Eats podcast about food and life. Every week on Special Sauce, we talk to some of the leading lights of American culture, food folks and non-food folks alike.
So because I'm charging $160 for an A5 Kobe steak in my steakhouse in Las Vegas, somehow I can't care about feeding people who are struggling?
This week, my guest is Tom Colicchio. Serious Eaters know Tom as the host and executive producer of Top Chef, the owner of the various and sundry crafts all over the country, the executive producer of the superb documentary on food insufficiency in America, A Place at the Table, and currently a food activist and contributor to MSNBC. Tom, welcome back to Special Sauce.
Thank you.
There are a lot of chefs involved in sustainability issues. A lot of chefs involved with, like Bill Telepan, with food in the schools, doing amazing stuff. Mm-hmm. But you are unique in your policy wonkiness.
Well, you know, listen, you're right. There are a lot of chefs are doing some great stuff. Paul Kahn has a program called Pilot Lights in Chicago. That's great. Mark Vetri
in Philadelphia
is doing a program. I forget the name of it now, but a program.
Both where great chefs
doing family meals and teaching kids to eat around a communal table versus getting that tray. So they're directly. And you mentioned Bill, and there's so many other chefs doing things, but they're directly getting involved. And so Michelle Nichon's doing great work. Jose Andres. You know, and chefs, you know, in New York, we're always asked to help raise money for various organizations, especially around hunger. You know, whether it's Meals on Wheels, God's Love,
right.
We Deliver,
Food Bank,
Share Our Strength. And so, you know, that's always, we've always sort of understood hunger in the context of how we can help charities raise money.
That's very direct.
Right. And so 5 years ago, my wife starts making film A Place at the Table, and I thought I knew a little bit about hunger. And I remember she came home and said, you know, Tom, I'm understanding this more. And people aren't hungry because of lack of resources, lack of food. People are because of policy. Because of policy. And the light just went on. And that's when I said, well, you know, because of that film and because of our stance, it gave me a different soapbox. And so it was like, all right, it's time to brush up on this stuff. And but I also... And I really believe this, that all the grassroots activism is great, and I support it. And grass tops activism, that's great as well. But at some point, if we want to take this food movement, and, you know, I come at the food movement from two sides. One side, or I try to marry the two, and this is my thinking. Again, this idea where I care about feeding hungry people nutritious food. I care about making that nutritious food as affordable and accessible as possible. And so I thought, well, okay, there's 47 million people who are struggling to feed themselves. Certainly that is a constituency that can go out and vote.
It's a mind-boggling number that I only learned at A Place at the Table.
How do we do that? Now, even if you discount the 13 million children who can't vote, you still have a big constituency, 16 million seniors. So you say, and they do vote. You know, older people tend to vote. But then you realize that this isn't a demographic that gets out to the polls. And so I said, well, how do you marry that with this food movement, these other people, you know, the Michael Pollans and the Mark Bittmans of the world who are looking at policy and are talking about sustainability. So how do you, people who tend to care about that stuff also care about feeding hungry people too. So how do you bring that together? And that's how Food Policy Action started, this organization that I co-founded with Ken Cook from the Environmental Working Group. And that's when we realized that if you want to take this social movement, this food movement—
And scale it.
Well, it needs to turn into a political movement.
I see.
And that's the only way it's going to actually gain some traction. And then once you realize that, then you got to understand policy. And listen, I may know a bit about policy, but I know nothing compared to a lot of the real policy wonks out there who really understand it. You can't understand the farm
but
bill.
You're a lay policy wonk.
Right, exactly. Mary Nessel just wrote a piece about the farm bill saying that she tried to get her arms around it. She tried to teach it, and it was impossible.
And that's Mary Nessel. The head
who knows
of nutrition
stuff,
studies
who,
at NYU.
Whenever I have a question, I call her. And so how do you create a political movement and how do you actually go there and lobby and do the hard work to change policy. Now, Michel Nishan is doing that the same, you know, the same thing with Wholesome Wave. He actually had language written to the farm bill. That's a big deal.
Yes. Yeah, and Michel is a fascinating guy and doing amazing work.
Right. And so, you know, I think at some point that if we wanna see food that is more affordable, more accessible, how do we affect that? How do we make that change happen? And it goes right to the farm bill, it goes right to subsidies. And so you have to understand that, you know, it's a real myopic view of the world, but if inside the bubble of the Beltway, if they don't hear about a food movement, there's no food movement as far as they're concerned.
Sure. And what about Michelle Obama? Because it seems like, you know, there was a big piece on Politico
last week.
And I learned a great deal, and I didn't realize that it was much more than just another first lady initiative to her.
Yeah. It was something that she was passionate about, and I got to say, this is where she was masterful, because she didn't push it the way, say, Hillary Clinton pushed healthcare. She took a different approach, and it was more of a soft pedal. But behind the scenes, there were some hard politics being played out. But it was wrapped up in a very nice package of let's move. But it's and she'll say this. This is just the beginning. See, you know, what I've learned is that you can't show up and do a few photo ops and think you've accomplished something. You have to go back. And so if we want to move the needle with school lunch, and she did a great job with that, she'll tell you it's just the beginning. We're looking 15 years, 20 years, 30 years down the road to make it better. It may not happen in my lifetime.
I think it's fair to say that she has had more influence on food policy than anyone in Washington in the last 25 years.
She's had yes. I think that she gave a lot of cover to a lot of people who were also doing a lot of work. There's been a lot of people who have been, you know, fighting this battle.
But she had the biggest megaphone.
She had the huge megaphone. But, you know, people, especially on the hunger side, like Jim McGovern and Rosa DeLauro. Jim McGovern is a congressman from Massachusetts. Rosa DeLauro is a congresswoman from
Connecticut.
Connecticut, yes.
I know my congressman.
Shelley Pingree, who's a congressman from Maine. There are a lot of people out there really, I'm sure I'm leaving some people out, that are real food champions and have been fighting this fight for a long time. But Michelle Obama, I mean, coming from the White House there's a lot of gravity to that position.
Yes.
And so, you know, yeah, it's just completely, you know, plowed the field a little bit to sort of, you know, let the rest of us fill in.
No pun intended.
Right.
Or maybe pun intended.
Pun intended, for the rest of us to fill in. And Sam Cass, who was their chef, who was a chef in Chicago, worked under Paul Kahn, and who they brought with them to help with policy, has just done a great job. Again, a lot of hard, you know, as it came out in the piece in Politico, of hard work behind the scenes.
It was, and I learned about it in that piece in Politico, which was why it was so great. And of course, we should say that Paul Kahn, for those of people who don't know out there, is a fantastic chef in Chicago who, with his partner Donnie Medea, owns Blackbird and Avec and taco joints. And he's really a very special person, even though he's very quiet and self-effacing.
And quite the music fanatic as well.
Yeah, so we're going to get to that, you know, because first of all, you know, my son has been complaining about the theme music for Special Sauce. So I thought you would appreciate this. So I listened to the Stevie Ray Vaughan track, and I was like, okay, this is the perfect intro to shut my son up. And then I called the people that I think were going to join their podcasting network, and they have a blanket license with ASCAP. I can use the Stevie Ray Vaughan track. And maybe yours will be the first one if the contract is done in time.
Very good.
You know, because I know you're a guitar freak. And this Stevie Ray Vaughan track kills.
Awesome.
The song is called Couldn't Stand
the
weather.
Yeah.
Think about it. Exactly.
Bum, bum, bum.
You got it. It's going to be awesome. I can't wait. So I want to talk briefly about your book,
Sweetgreens. We're going to come to eat your lunch.
Yes.
Nah.
Your book, Think Like a Chef, was really groundbreaking in many, many ways. What was the thinking behind Think Like a Chef? Because nobody was doing that.
Yeah.
I mean, it wasn't another chef's cookbook.
That's exactly why I didn't want to write a cookbook. And everybody kept saying, you got to write a cookbook. I'm like, no, I don't want to write a cookbook. And finally, I was like, all right, I'll do this. But my idea was I wanted to teach people to cook the way I learned to cook without, you know, getting rid of the recipes. But you have to provide recipes to show people how to do that. But give people this idea of how do you put dishes together? How do you make things work together? And I got lucky with this one. I'll tell you why. One of the waiters who worked at Kraft, his name is Sean Fry. And Sean is brilliant, just very, very smart guy. And we were trying to do this book where he was, writing in his voice, but then also then trying to write in my voice. You know,
it's hard.
He's a smart, not a writer. I'm sure he turned in a lot of good papers, but he's not a writer.
Right.
The manuscript was a mess. I mean, it got turned in. It was like, oh my God, my wife is a writer. We did all the recipe testing and a lot of the discussion around the book in my apartment at the time. It was a studio apartment, and my wife was always like in the other, at her desk, like doing whatever she was doing, but kind of one ear. She's like, we can't. This doesn't sound like you, and we got to clean this up. And within a week, she rewrote the entire thing.
Wow.
And then it came down to this introduction that I had to get this introduction of my career in here, and I kept putting her off. And then I remember it was one Sunday morning, we woke up. And I was like, you ready? Because it's coming right now. And just a couple hours. And I got to say, she nailed it.
Wow, that's great.
And Kathy Young, who did all the recipe testing, just did such a great job because I hate writing recipes. And so the first recipes that we were testing, I went out and bought all this measuring stuff and I'm starting to measure. And the food was terrible. I was like, God, this isn't working. I can't do this. So I said, Kathy, here's the deal. You're going to have to just watch me. And just you write everything down. I'm going to cook. I'm going to sit at my stove at home and I'm going to cook. And I want you to ask questions. And she just did an amazing job of getting this information out of me. And then I would go to her house. She would recreate the dishes and I'd run to her house and taste them. And that's how we did the book.
Yeah. You really wanted to teach people to think like a chef when they're cooking.
Yes.
And in the same, Kenji Lopez-Alt, the managing culinary director, mm-hmm. Who has Food Lab, Better Home Cooking Through Science, is the same way.
Yeah.
He really wants people to think about what they're cooking.
Yep.
And it's that same desire that fueled probably your book and his book.
Mm-hmm.
You wanted to take them on an adventure, not so that they can make the best risotto. That may be the end result and may not be, but that wasn't why you did it.
Yeah, I like his new risotto recipe. It's actually pretty cool.
I'll tell him that.
Yeah, I just read that last week. It was really cool. I wanted to make people better cooks. That was really it. So how do you think about cooking?
Right, just like Kenji. It's exactly right.
Right. And so I remember one dish in particular. We were doing this vegetable stew soup or something. And I had a pretty good size, rondeau that you have, about this big. And turned up the heat. I put some oil in the pan. And I had all the vegetables cut, ready to go. And I started adding it to the pan. And I was sitting there just kind of like gently stirring. And then I add a little more. Mm-hmm. And then I add a little more. And Kathy said to me, what are you doing? So I'm putting the vegetables in the pan. She said, no, you're doing something here. And I'm trying to understand it. She said, what are you doing? And I thought about it. I was like, oh, well, what I'm doing is the heat's turned all the way up. Now, I know if I take all these vegetables and put them in, they're just going to start to steam because the heat's going to drop in the pan and then it's going to be warm. And then what's going to happen is the juices that are coming out of the vegetables, instead of evaporating out, they're just going to collect and they're not going to cook as nicely. So what I'm doing is I'm regulating the temperature. So I put the vegetables in, the heat goes down a little bit. And now I'm listening and I can hear it sputtering and it's getting faster and faster and faster. Time to add more vegetables. And then it goes down again, and it comes back up again. Time to add more. And you keep adding more. And you would think that well, aren't the vegetables that you put in first going to cook before the other ones? It actually doesn't happen. Somehow, and I'm sure Kenji can explain this, some equilibrium happens inside the pan.
Right.
And it all just works. And she said, that's fascinating. We talked about it in the book. But that was the kind of relationship that we had where she would say, what you're doing is not what a home cook does.
Right.
And not what a typical recipe would teach
call
you.
For.
They would say, just put it in.
Yeah.
And but this was it. I'm thinking, and I'm using all my senses when I'm cooking, and I'm looking at what's going on. And you know, like typically, and now people start to, you know, you see, cook a steak on one side for 5 minutes, flip it, cook it on the side. No, you know, you turn it a few times, you know?
Right.
And so these were the you know, a lot of this happened as you were going through the process. But the idea was just to make people better cooks.
Yeah. Yeah. Worst mistake you ever made in somebody else's kitchen?
Worst mistake I ever made in somebody else's kitchen? I got to go back a long time. when I was working in somebody else's kitchen.
There wasn't one that came to mind where somebody threw the plate of lasagna at you?
Yeah,
or...
you know, I got to say, you know, Thomas and I are good friends now. But when I left his kitchen, it was one of those you can't fire me, I quit moments. You know, he was just pushed and pushed and pushed. This was a mistake. Now, it's not a mistake, like, you know, I overcooked something. This was
right.
The mistake. So, again, I said earlier that he created this atmosphere. But he also was really generous in that he let you help create dishes. But it was because you were talking about food. He would say, hey, this is coming in. I got a few, you know, let's talk about it. And so you'd kind of say, well, how about this and how about this and how about this? And he would say, yeah, okay, great. And a dish would end up, you know, as a special or something. And I'm sitting there going, these are my dishes. And I really thought that until I had my own kitchen. And I realized that the only reason that stuff was on there was because he created that environment to do that.
Yes.
And that was the mistake. The mistake was thinking that I actually had much more of a hand in creating that dish than I did.
So I think I gave A Place at the Table short shrift. So I just want to talk a little bit more about that because that was a very moving film for me. In fact, I shed quite a few tears because one of the things that you and Lori, your wife, did—
and Christy Jacobson, who was the other director,
right,
producer—
did an amazing job of taking the story of four disparate Americans,
mm-hmm,
and really made you see that this is one America,
yeah,
that we're trying to feed, whether you're black, brown,
right,
white,
right,
whether you lived in Montana, Philadelphia, wherever you were, that these were issues that were universal and that that a lot of people didn't know because we weren't connecting the dots in the same
right
way that you said you weren't connecting the dots until your wife brought it to
right
your attention.
Right. Now, first off, I get way too much credit for that. I was an executive producer brought on because I had some name recognition to help get this thing financed. I'll be serious.
Sure.
And did I help once those stories were there? And yeah, in a small sense, but Christy and Lori made the film.
Mm-hmm.
And
your wife's last name is Silverbush.
Silverbush,
not,
yeah.
Not
yeah
Colicchio.
Right. And, you know, what happened was Lori is a narrative filmmaker and a screenwriter. And when she was mentoring a young girl, and the young girl had some learning disabilities. And in New York City, if the public schools can't meet the child's need, you can actually put them into private school and the city has to pay for it. And so we did that. And right after the school year started, we got a call from the principal saying that this young woman was scrounging around in the garbage for food. And what we didn't realize is they didn't have a breakfast or lunch program like the public school do. And, you know, Lori came home and she's like, I can't believe this. She goes, this idea of people going hungry, I need to explore it. And she's like, I have to make a film. And she's not a documentary filmmaker, so she reached out to her friend Christy Jacobson, who is, and they got together. And where I think they did a great job, and what you locked into, is they didn't just present a problem; they told stories.
Absolutely.
And when you see the stories,
heart-wrenching.
Yeah, and when you see these young kids and parents struggling with feeding their children, and you see the stories, and you see rural Mississippi, and you see hunger in Colorado, and you know, you expect it in the inner cities.
Right.
That's what we've come to know in the face of hunger in this country anyway. But we're seeing it everywhere. Every county in this country has people that are hungry. Right. Every county.
Wow.
And so, you know, at some point as a country, we have to look at it and say, you can't blame people.
Right, you know, for not being hardworking enough.
Right,
or...
and then when you see the stats, you know, the average person is on food stamps or SNAP for 10 months. And it's usually because they're trying to get, you know, they lost a job or something's happened, they got sick. And, you know, it's not this chronic overuse of a handout. And the idea that we sort of put people in these camps of makers and takers, you know, it's just wrong. You know, I think that what I think we really helped do was bring the issue of hunger to so many people who thought most people think hunger, homelessness. That's it. That's the end of it. There's no hunger here. People don't see hunger here because it doesn't look like what we're conditioned to understand hunger is sort of the Sally Struthers commercials and flies buzzing around some kid in sub-Saharan Africa. And so we don't know what to look for. And so if you think about 1 in 6 people in this country are food insecure, which means that during the course of you know the week they'll struggle to put food on the table.
You know, how is that possible?
How is that possible in this country?
Yeah,
and why would we think that charities could take care of this problem? See, that's the real payoff that we talked about is that you know we took care of hunger back in the 70s, and it took another film called Hunger in America. It was a CBS film that a third of the population saw because at the time there were only three networks, and you know one public TV channel, and then politicians got together, and it was McGovern and Dole who got together to modernize food stamps, modernize the school nutrition programs, signed into law by Richard Nixon because people cared about feeding hungry people in this country, and then we pretty much got rid of hunger, and then the 80s come. And it all changes. And it's all charities can take care of the problem. Government's the problem. Government's not the solution. So how could government take care of this problem?
Right. The 1,000 points of light didn't take care of the problem?
Didn't take care of the problem. It made the problem worse. And so when the problem is that pervasive, charities can't fix it. And what's really happened, because of the cuts and because of the economy tanking in 2007, the needs just grew, and that's the kind of program that SNAP is. It's countercyclical, so as the needs grow, it grows. It's not like you take a pile of money and go, here's the pile of money for food stamps. It doesn't work that way.
Right.
And so the needs grew, and you know, we go out and raise money. You know, we'll go do a food bank event and raise $1 million in one night. Great. Well, this is an $80 billion program. If you cut $10 billion out of the program and you change the eligibility— so people aren't eligible anymore. How many of those $1 million nights do we have to do to make up for $10 billion?
Right.
You can't do it.
And that's where food policy action comes in.
Right. And so, and this is also, I think, the message that we were able to give to a lot of the charities that are very instrumental in feeding people, saying that, you know what, guys, we're a stopgap here. You government needs to fix this problem.
Yeah.
Yeah. And that's where food policy action was an offshoot of, you know, the my thinking around the film. Yeah.
And it's you live this bifurcated life, you know, as an activist, which you're obviously very passionate about, but you're also very passionate about food. Like, is it necessary to reconcile the two, or do you not worry about it? And it's just like two parts of your personality.
I don't worry about it. It's very easy to compartmentalize the both pieces of it. You know, on one hand, you know, someone will go, you limousine liberal, you're charging $160 for a Kobe steak in your restaurant. So what? So because I'm charging $160 for an A5 Kobe steak or Wagyu steak in my steakhouse in Las Vegas, somehow I can't care about feeding
right
people who are
right.
struggling.
Right. One actually has a lot to do with the other.
It actually does. It actually does. And so I don't understand it, and you know I've learned to ignore it, and it makes perfect sense actually.
All right, so now it's time for the special sauce 5-minute buffet. By the way, I can't tell you how excited I am that you're excited about Stevie Ray Vaughan being the theme music, and you know that song. I know, and then he does the thing with the cording.
Yeah.
Oh, it's awesome,
Stevie Ray.
What's in your desert island fridge? There's electricity.
Okay.
Could be five things.
Well, the things I always have, for some reason, my refrigerator now, there's always a stick of some sort of cured meat, always.
Okay.
Always. There's always cheese, always a hunk of Parmesan cheese, you know, in the refrigerator. What else would I have? Let me see. If I had –
So you got three more.
It's a couple things. So if I had to live the rest of my life on a few things.
Yeah.
I can't get enough – you know, mushrooms would have to be in there.
Okay.
And
these are all very umami-oriented.
Yeah. But also mushrooms. I have a theory. I love mushrooms. I love beets.
Okay.
I think it's the closest thing you can get to eating dirt. And
okay.
As kids, what do? As kids, we make mud pies, and
yes,
you always right. try to eat one,
all
right?
That's good.
So we want to eat dirt. Brings all us back right. to our childhood, where I think we always want to somehow get
right.
back to.
So we'll say mushrooms / beets as your third.
Mushrooms. If I had to deal with one vegetable, leeks.
Okay.
I do a lot with it. Leeks, fennel.
Okay.
Yeah, that could be it.
All right. You got one more.
Well, you got to drink something.
And?
You have to drink something. So,
right.
I don't know. Is it wine or beer? I'm not sure.
Could be either one.
That's a tough one. Because, like, you don't need to refrigerate bourbon. So, what? If I had to choose
but,
one.
But, you know, you could still be bourbon. It could be outside the fridge.
Well, see, that's different. You said in the fridge. So I can
okay.
have a lot of stuff
all
outside
right.
the fridge.
But okay.
And so if I were on an island, it would probably end up being beer.
Okay.
It's more nutritious. You need nutrition.
Would it be like a designery beer? Would it be PBR? Or does it really matter?
No, you see, I think at that point it's got to be like a lager.
Okay.
You know, something you can actually drink and, you know, drink a lot of it because you're going to be drinking a lot of it. You know, some of the some
you have
of the,
a lot of time.
I love the craft beers, but, you know, one or two and you're done.
Okay.
You can't drink a lot.
All right.
Yeah.
Who's at your last supper? No family allowed.
Oh, if I could sit down and have a meal with anyone,
yep.
It would probably be Franklin Roosevelt.
Franklin Roosevelt. So that's actually my second question, which would be, the person living or dead you'd like to break bread with over lunch. So talk to me about FDR.
God, I mean, I think he was the greatest president we ever had. It's probably not surprising if you know my politics. I think it would just be fascinating to hear his take on politics today. I think he is you know uniquely you know qualified right now to lead this country.
Yeah.
But. Boy, it's a different world we're living in, but I would love to hear what he had to say about our current state of politics.
Yeah, for sure. So if you could have four people at dinner.
Dinner. That are living?
Yeah,
so
they could
living.
Be living or dead.
Living
but,
or dead.
Yeah, all right.
Seconds.
So if you want to limit it to living is fine.
I mean, you know, if it were dead, seriously, if it were dead, you know, I recently
okay.
did a, well, last season, Finding Your Roots.
Right.
And, boy, if I could sit down and number one, I'd have to learn how to speak Italian. My
right.
great-grandfather,
okay.
who came back and forth from Italy three or four times.
But he is in your family, so, you
know. Oh, right. My family members, yeah. Okay, I got it. I was going to say he came back and
yeah.
forth. And I'm sure he was in steerage. I mean, I guess Jimi Hendrix would be cool as hell to sit down and have a meal with, huh?
Awesome.
You know, I never got to see him play live.
Eleanor Roosevelt?
Yeah, that would be interesting. Yeah,
so, I mean, first of all, I like the idea of Eleanor and Jimi Hendrix. That's awesome.
That would be fun, huh?
All right, so two more people to fill out the table.
Bobby Kennedy.
Bobby Kennedy.
Yeah.
All right, I like this.
Yeah.
You got it going a little political.
Yeah.
You know, is there a comedian or an actor that you particularly admire? A painter, a philosopher.
Yeah, but I don't know. You know, I'm trying to think of the mix of people here.
Yeah, I know, because it's a dinner party. You always
yeah,
have to think
party,
about the
yeah,
mix.
And who's sitting next to who?
Could be
Alexander Hamilton. You know?
Alexander Hamilton.
Yeah, you know, Hamilton's. You know, I did see the play, and I just finished reading.
I'm loving
Hamilton,
this
the book, and he's talking about a fascinating
guy. And who would
guy.
Pick up the tab?
Well, Hamilton was the Secretary of the Treasury.
All right, so he would. All right, that makes sense. So,
that's a funny group.
That's
but.
Fine. That's a great group. Are you kidding? And what are you eating?
Sunday gravy.
With good bread.
Yeah.
That's awesome. All right. Guilty pleasure. What's the thing that you know that your politics and your health would dictate that you wouldn't eat, but that you just give in to?
Within the last couple of years, I got rid of a lot of those vices. I'm still a sucker for a pint of ice cream, and I will finish the whole pint.
The whole pint?
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Flavor? Brand?
Brand. You know, there's so many of these cool little brands
these
days.
Yeah, the craft ice creams are awesome.
There's always a different kind of refrigerator, and I got to be careful not to kill the whole pint.
Yeah.
It all depends. I don't like all chocolate.
Okay.
Chocolate chip mint, I'm not a fan of.
Maybe Grater's black raspberry chocolate chip.
That would do it. That's fine. That's good.
It's pretty awesome.
They sent me. I don't know who sent it to me. I got a whole box full of Grater's a couple of years ago. Probably, I don't know, a dozen pints.
And it lasted a week.
I killed it. Yeah.
All right. Thank you so much for sharing special sauce.
This was fun. So special sauce. Remember that line from Fast Times at Ridgemont High?
No.
What's your special sauce?
No.
Judge Reinhardt.
That's
great.
Right.
Come on.
Please log on to Food Policy Action. It's really awesome. Today I logged on and I saw what grade my congressman gets, which is one of the most fun things to see how your congressman grades out. See A Place at the Table. It's streaming on Netflix. Mm-hmm. It's something that everyone should see. It will change the way you think about food insufficiency in this country. And of course, watch Top Chef on Bravo. And until next time, Serious Eaters, thanks for listening.